Welcome, a listener, to another episode of Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug. This is episode 121 of the podcast, and we have another great discussion lined up for you, and another one that I am completely absent from. But big thanks to Harmony Dragon and Draxanath for carrying this discussion forward. And wow, do they go over a plethora of topics. I think they started with City of Heroes because, of course, that was in the news at the time that we recorded that. There was that big fan-run server that had come to light, and then it subsequently got shuttered. But then apparently the developers were, like, negotiating with NCSoft to maybe have it run, and I actually have no idea where that's at these days. But from there, they move on to other NCSoft games, Tabula Rasa in particular, and then they move on to even lesser-known titles like Blimpo Warrior and its sequel. From there, the discussion moves on to the difficulties of dealing with hard-coded IRQ settings in old Packard Bell computers, before things switch gears and they start talking about manipulating graphics tiles in old Nintendo Entertainment System ROMs, which in turn morphs into a broader discussion of the technology of tile graphics and early forays into programming languages of different kinds. The closeout of the episode is an interesting story about the fan translation of Final Fantasy V and a broader look at the fan translation scene and how it's kind of, in a weird way, it brings it all full circle. Because if you think about it, you know, we start talking about City of Heroes, or they start by talking about City of Heroes in a fan-run server that NCSoft takes action to shut down. It ends with a discussion about fan translation projects, which often also get shut down by publishers and developers, or, you know, get sent cease and desist orders. So it's kind of a roundabout way the episode is about all the crazy stuff that fans get up to, just trying to better love and appreciate the games that they enjoy playing, and how developers and publishers don't always see eye to eye with fans when it comes to these efforts. Also, just a reminder, of course, Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug is now hosted on Anchor.fm. It's a newer podcast hosting platform, a little bit more social in its feel and style. You can find us at anchor.fm/sssh podcast or at spamspamspamhumbug.com. And if you do visit us on Anchor, you can take advantage of some of the community features there. You can leave us voice messages up to a minute in duration or give our episodes applause. And if you're listening in the Anchor app, you can also favorite individual episodes or the entirety of the podcast. If you do the smart home thing, you can find us on the Apple HomePod or on Google Home. Try saying, "Hey Siri," or "Hey Google," as the case may be. Play the podcast, Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug, and, you know, see what happens. I don't think we're on Alexa yet, though. But if we are, please let me know. And as always, this episode of the podcast is brought to you by our Patreon backers. Thank you to everyone who supports the podcast and the Codex by that means. And an especially hearty thank you to our co-producers, Seth, Golden Flame, Chris, Brickbat, Dominic, Violation, Cranberry, Christopher, Bruce, Darkwraith Dragon, Helgriff, Gronk, Pascal, and Thorwan. Oh, and speaking of Patreon, we have a note of thanks to offer. We have a new patron as of last week. Big thank you to Ryan for contributing to the ongoing maintenance of the Ultima Codex and the ongoing publication of Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug. Right, all that said, let's get down to the episode. Here's Harmony Dragon and Draxanath. Enjoy the show.
Given the fact that City of Heroes was the first MMORPG that I ever got a character to max level in, the first one that I ever did any sort of meaningful endgame stuff in, I put years of my life into that game. So hearing that it might be coming back is... And that's just a big thing to me, because for the longest time, I spent so much of my life playing that game when I was younger. I made so many friends that the idea that it might be coming back is just huge.
I remember I had a character, Horn Igniter. All the powers, primary and secondary, were fire-based. And it was really sad what happened. It got shut down.
Oh.
It's one of the things first I used to play Tabula Rasa. Then they shut it down, so I moved to City of Heroes.
Then they shut that down.
They shut it down again. Then I moved to Exteel. And they shut it down, so I say, to hell with NCSoft. All the games I don't like, they still have them. And those I like, they shut them down.
Yeah, my big thing that I played, that I was known for, was Scrapper. I played martial arts in Regeneration.
I was a blaster, I think it's called, the ranged character.
And this was back in the day when martial arts, when back before any issues, when it was just vanilla, was seen as the weakest of the scrapper sets by people because of the animation times. And Regeneration was seen as the weakest of the scrapper defense sets because nobody got them to any decent level and weren't seeing what the, you know, really good regeneration powers did. So I tried to make a character that I thought was going to be very weak and very laughable. And I made, you know, I put everything I could into maximizing that character and making them as good as they could or they could be. And I think I might have been partially responsible for that class getting nerfed. But something I've been noticing following the press for this is how many people were, you know, it goes to show just how many people loved that game. And to me, that's just, I made a lot of good memories playing City of Heroes, but I also made a lot of terrible personal mistakes, things that I regret. But
I still have City of Heroes installed.
You haven't formatted your computer in 6 years?
Actually, I have I got a new computer, and I have the, well, it's been already several years since then. But I keep the hard drives from the previous computer. So I have the hard drive from the new computer plus the two hard drives I had on the old one. And City of Heroes is there. Let me see, what do we have here? City of Heroes, Tabula Rasa.
As much as Sirgorn would like to say that Tabula Rasa was a mess and it not remotely what it should have been, and he's not wrong, I loved Tabula Rasa at the time.
I did, too.
To be fair, I almost didn't come in tonight for the recording because a certain movie came out today that I want to see and probably won't be seeing for months. And I'm sure everybody's going to be talking about it.
I'm looking at the old hard drive. Arcanum, Baldur's Gate 2.
Ooh, Baldur's Gate. That brings back some memories. I've never got that far in the second game. I beat the first game about a half a dozen different ways.
Diablo 2.
Oh,
Dungeon Siege. And Lazarus and Ultima 6 Project.
Lazarus, wasn't that when they did Ultima 5 in the Dungeon Siege engine and, you know, expanded a lot of different storylines and such?
Yes, that's the one. And there's also Ultima 6 Project, which is the for Ultima 6 from the same team, or mostly the same team. And it's for Dungeon Siege as well. I have the Tabula Rasa public test server build, the last one. I have TRE, which is the name of the Tabula Rasa server emulator. I played around with it.
Yeah, I heard that they got it to where it was almost playable, but NCSoft did a cease and desist.
That happened. And it disappeared for a while, but they're still working on it underground. I got a hold of them some time ago and got their latest source code and built it.
Interesting.
Did some more testing.
You know, technically it's kind of not kosher, but given the fact that from when I looked at things on the City of Heroes subreddit, that over 30,000 people have signed up for this server, that, you know, I'm sure that that NCSoft knows that if they were to go after it at this point, you know, and which they are legally within their rights to do, that they would probably be ensuring that that's a large chunk of dedicated game players. It's not going to, that's going to talk with their wallets.
Yeah. Well, I have the Ultima Collection installed in full. And Wing Commander 3.
Oh, that brings back some memories.
Yeah, I remember I used to play it on DOSBox, and I had all four CDs in ISO format. I created the ISO images from my original CDs.
I still played
on DOSBox.
I still have my boxed copy sitting on my bookshelf with literally within where I can see it from here.
Yeah, and I never touched Wing Commander 4. I wanted to finish Wing Commander 3 before getting to 4.
4, from what I hear, has a better story. It's less, you know, it actually gets darker and more gritty. But what's sad is looking over there where my collection of old games are, I'm also seeing my high school yearbook, which was dated 1995. Makes me feel all sorts of old.
Yeah, and the list of games, I also have American McGee's Alice. Extil is still installed here. Unreal Tournament 2003.
I remember Extil. It was a arena shooter sort of deathmatchy game, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And right. I remember doing a lot of sliding around and strafing in a high speed mech while shooting somebody with twin guns.
Duke Nukem 3D. Dungeon Keeper. What else do we have here? Blimpo Warrior.
Blimpo, what was that Warrior one again?
Two. Blimpo Warrior 2.
Never heard of that one.
You can find it at itch.io. The author of the game is Spran, S-P-R-A-N. An old friend from 20 plus years ago, from indie game dev community I belong to. Okay.
That's talking some classic stuff. Let's see.
Yeah, okay. This is Spram's webpage at itch.io.
You're linking this?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So
Blimpo Warrior is I think it came before Zizi's Island. Zizi's Island is only $1.99. Blimpo Warrior 2 is free. I also have Blimpo Warrior 1, which is much simpler, quite old, and the humor is very silly. It's a Blimpo Warrior. The original one is a dungeon. It's a Dragon Warrior parody.
The art that I'm seeing here looks like a combination of multiple different games at once. I'm seeing some Earthbound here, some RPG Maker, some volleyball, and a chopper. Get that. Okay.
Volleyball game, mini game. Everything in that game was a mini game. You can watch the trailer there.
Another time. I have a problem with Discord. When I go to have anything with audio while I'm in voice, it broadcasts the audio over my voice. And I learned that the hard way because I was watching something that was not suitable for work while in a voice chat with my Dungeons & Dragons group. And they were like, Harmony, what are you listening to? It was a video from an old retired Army drill sergeant poking fun at some of the things that drill sergeants do. And he was using the kind of language you would expect a military, if you've ever heard the term swearing like a sailor.
And the notes. It's not professional. It's not polished. It's buggy. The game might crash all the time. The game has resolution of 320 by 200 for some reason.
I would love to see somebody try to run a 320 by 200 game in full screen on a modern PC just to watch their video card melt. I remember always thinking it was every time I've had to do a default resolution jump up over the years, I've always seen it as some sort of quantum leap. My first computer was 386, a Packard Bell. I don't know if you had that brand down there, but they were one of the go-to cheap computer brands back in the day that sold computers in like department stores and such.
Back then, my dad said it was not preferable to buy brands, so he always bought parts and built the computer, and that's what I am used to do as well.
Well, I grew up in the middle of nowhere, a very rural town. We would have to have driven about 90 miles. I would say that's about 130, 140 kilometers to the nearest town that had a shop that sold computers. And this was way before we had, Newegg or Tiger Direct. This was even before the internet was widespread. There were BBSs at the time, but I wasn't getting anywhere with a 2400 BPS modem. Well, anyway, Packard Bell was notorious at the time for not using standard parts, for doing things like soldering the modem, right into the expansion port so you could not remove it, or using their own custom port for keyboards and mice, so you had to get your mouse directly from Packard Bell.
It's annoying.
What was really bad was they used a custom BIOS, which was hard written to where you could not use anything other than the factory standard parts that came in your machine. Upgrading a Packard Bell was a nightmare because this was the days of IRQs and DMAs and all that sort of happy nonsense. I'm sure you remember those days.
Yes. And using jumpers to set up the IRQ, the DMA, and everything.
Well,
before plug and play.
Well, for Christmas one year, my parents decided they were going to treat me and got me a 33.6 modem to replace the 2400 modem that I had so I could actually do something on the internet. This was on the 486 that I had as my second computer. Well, it used a range of IRQs that the BIOS did not have available to set anything for, because it said, oh no, those IRQs don't exist. You can't set anything to those.
Yeah.
So I pulled out the manual and found out why. Apparently IRQ number whatever was specifically for the serial mouse port. So I managed to somehow fool the BIOS into thinking that the modem was using the serial mouse's IRQ. I don't know how we did this, but anytime I tried to connect to the internet, if I had a serial mouse connected, it just stopped working. So we had to go out and special get a PS2 mouse just so I could use it. Anyway, this is a very roundabout way to get to the story I was trying to originally tell. Is in those early days, 640 by 480 was, or was the standard in the days of DOS and VGA. You know, yeah, certain high quality, you know, high color graphics would have swapped to 320 by 200. But the default system resolution at the time that everything expected was 640 by 480. Then eventually I moved to Windows 95 and 98. And suddenly I was no longer using 640 by 480, but 800 by 600. Mm. Things looked so much sharper and crisper. Then we got to Windows ME and Windows. Yes, I actually used Windows Millennium for a long time and Windows XP after that and Vista. And then I was using 1024 by 768, and I used that resolution for about 10 years. Now I'm to 1080p on a 42-inch screen, mostly because I'm half blind, and this allows me to actually lean back and see what I'm doing without my face right near to the screen.
Mm-hmm. I used to have my face close to the screen, I wasn't seeing. I could not see very well. I could see. Some people talk about seeing double image, but in my case, I had triple image. I could see the main image and two ghost images. And then I got surgery on my eyes, and now I'm 20/20 sight.
Even with glasses, I'm at like 20/40.
Mm-hmm. Well, this one, Blimple Warrior, the original was a DOS game, and then someone ported the engine to Windows, and we were able to play it again on Windows, but it doesn't seem to work very well after. After XP.
Yeah, I've noticed that a lot of your early DOS games just don't, or early Windows games don't like to run in modern Windows, especially stuff from the 95-98 era. And that's a problem for me, because a lot of the older games that I used to love to play and would love to play again, I can't play now, because 64-bit Windows 10 would just, you know, kind of vomit on them. I mean, I actually dug out my old Ultima Collection CD-ROM recently and, you know, popped it into my Alienware, and it essentially gave me a, what do I do with this?
Testing here. Well, the engine runs, but the resolution is just wrong for the original Blimple Warrior, so we would need to play it on a virtual machine. It was a very funny game, the Dragon Warrior parody, and the second one, Blimple Warrior 2, it's sort of the same, but there's a new mana, a new Blimple Lord menacing the world. So you go to the king, and the king says that you can go home because he hired a new hero, someone other than you. And that's what the game's all about. The original hero from the previous game trying to save the world without support from the king. The original Blimple Warrior takes a lot of RPG tropes from that time and makes fun of them.
That seems to be common.
Yeah, but it does that. Since it's a parody game and it has a very silly humor, It does things very, very direct, very blatant. There's a stage a level where you cannot pass. There's a bonfire blocking your way, and you need to go through that. And you wander around and you find another character and says, I have to join your party. And he asks, why is that? And he says, because I know how to go through the campfire. And, oh, all right, then join me. So you go back to the campfire, and then the other character says, okay, let me handle this. And he just turns sideways, and the campfire goes off. And then your main character says, hey, I could have done that myself. And then the other says, yes, but then there wouldn't be no point in me joining. Oh, okay. And then you go, you continue.
I'm trying to think of obscure indie stuff that I've played recently. I don't really know if it counts as indie, but I think the last truly indie game that I've played recently was Axiom Verge.
Not played that.
It's a Metroidvania style game. And very well done, very atmospheric. They got the color palettes just so that it looks and feels like you're playing an old NES game. Sorry for the sniffling. I'm having an allergy issue today. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Are you all right?
Yes, I'm replying to someone. I'm looking at the list of all the games I have here. All the indie games from around 20 years ago. Let's see. The names. Blameful Warrior. Legend of the Little People. This one's very silly. It's because the guy had a sprite of 16 by 32 size, and all their sprites were 16 by 16 ripped from Final Fantasy IV, I think.
Okay.
So he had a large character, and the others were Final Fantasy IV characters, 16 by 16 pixels. So the game was Legend of the Little People. It was very silly. Lord of the Ikuzo.
Talking about character art, there was a time when I considered myself a hobbyist ROM hacker. By hobbyist, I mean what I did was very, very simple, basic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I had a tile layer program that could look at the graphic data in a NES or Game Boy ROM and allow you to actually manipulate the various 8x8 graphic tiles and edit them to your liking. So naturally, the 19-year-old, me, who was fresh out of dropping out of college, got access to this. And I took a copy of Super Mario Brothers 1 and turned Mario into giant genitals. But it was interesting to see how they worked the sprites. I mean, I learned a little bit on how they did that, or how they did so.
Mm-hmm.
And how they would recycle data, especially in RPGs, where you'd see monsters that looked a lot alike. It would almost look like, oh, they took the top or the bottom half of a certain monster and just changed it a little bit about the graphics for the next version of the monster. Well, mm-hmm. If you look at the tile graphics, what they were doing is they were actually using the top bottom half graphic from the original monster and had different art for the, or had different tiles for the new monster top.
Yeah. That's a technique that was used a lot on console games back then.
Well, that was back.
I remember when I was teaching game programming, I was explaining those techniques, and we had the brand new XNA Game Studio. Microsoft gave us free Visual Studio licenses and also the free subscription for XNA Game Studio. So I was using material from their community, and they had a sort of a tutorial for tile graphics and everything. And I was reading the material from the person who developed that tutorial for tile graphics, and really my thoughts on what the guy wrote and what he explained about the tile graphics, I think it's not appropriate for me to say what I thought about it. But he didn't have any idea of why tile graphics were so, of why they existed. And the demo he had for tile graphics, did nothing of what the tile graphics were meant for. He said tile graphics were used to make it easier to build scenarios. And I looked at the graphics, the tile graphics he had. There were a lot of repetitive tiles. There were a lot of repeated tiles with only very small details changing from one another. And the tiles were very large. And I thought, well, if he had any idea of what tile graphics are and what they were meant for, he would have done tile graphics about one quarter or one eighth of the size of the tiles he made, and that would eliminate the waste. And there was a lot of waste in that tutorial, and I thought to myself, this guy is trying to teach the world how to make tiles, and he has absolutely no idea of the purpose of tile graphics at all.
Well, it was something I also remember from that time was they had so much of a limit to how much RAM they could use, how much video data they could have up into RAM at one time, how much storage you had, and how much, and having to make a game that lasted 20-30 hours with 128 kilobytes or 256 K of space.
Mm-hmm.
Now, compare the art that I saw done with 64K of a storage space, say for Dragon Warrior 1, one of my favorite games growing up in high school, then going to college and starting to learn C++. And being told, okay, for every program you write in this class, you're going to include this and this and this and this, and you will not execute it from the emulator or from the interpreter. You will compile it and then you will submit it. I would end up getting 32K just to have something that printed "Hello World" to the screen, because of all the overhead stuff that I had to do, just because the teacher said I had to do it, and the way he taught was, you don't need to know why it does that yet. You just need to know that it does it, and then we will teach you why. And that made no sense to me, because I was always very big when I was younger on knowing why things did what they did, how they worked. It wasn't good enough for me to simply go ahead.
Well, in that case, you needed to learn assembly first. Because if you want to know how it works, you need to learn assembly firsthand. Otherwise, you just have to accept that you're not going to get an explanation.
All right. Because my first foray into programming was, well, back while we were trying to find me a workable computer that wasn't a PC, because at the time PCs were very hard to find. So for a couple of years, like from 7th and 8th grade, I had a TRS-80 up connected to my TV in my bedroom. And I taught myself BASIC on my TRS-80, which I also used on a friend's VIC-20 that they decided they didn't want anymore and said, hey, this is yours if you want it.
Mm-hmm.
In doing so, I got rather comfortable with BASIC and the various variants of BASIC you had, like extended color BASIC on the TRS-80 you had. I forgot what it was called on the Commodore 64. Then you had Apple BASIC on the Apple II. Then for DOS, you had GW BASIC and Q BASIC and BASICA. But all of them mostly used similar concepts. About the biggest one that had any differences was QBASIC to me. And QBASIC was one that did away with line numbers, and you could have subroutines or subprograms as discrete files that you called up here and there. Mm-hmm. Now, I got to where I considered some of what I did fairly elegant and fairly interesting, even if it was just basic mm-hmm. stuff like making random number generators for rolling dice, because I was poor and I had a TRS-80, but I didn't have a dice bag.
Well, I did a little of BASIC on Commodore VIC-20. And I learned a little of assembly for the x86 architecture, and also for, I don't remember the other architecture. What was it? But it used load and store. It's a different kind of architecture. It's the same one. It's basically the same that the ARM processors use. It's quite different. The x86 architecture, the assembly instructions are able to access memory directly. On the other hand, the ARM architecture, the load and store architecture, they need you to load information into registers. You have to, first on a register, you have to put the address you want to access, and then use the load instruction and give it another register. And tell from what register is it going to read the address you're going to access. Then you load that. You have the register with the data ready. And then you can operate on it. And once you do the operation, then you store it with another instruction to another address. So it's different and it's quite fun.
Yeah. I quickly learned after I got to college and was, you know, full of myself, I didn't realize just how arrogant I really was as a young kid until I got to college. And all of my thinking in BASIC and thinking I could do so much with BASIC, then I got to seeing C+ or C and my brain started melting.
Mm-hmm. Direct memory access. Templates for data types, for classes, and everything underlying and in between, and writing and putting assembly routines within C code inline assembly.
But, you know, when you're learning assembly, aren't you essentially learning assembly specific to whatever processor family that you're learning, that you're working with?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that make it complicated when you have so many different offshoots of the quote-unquote PC compatible? But that's using 1980s dialogue or 1980s concepts. I mean, given that they have so many core this and core that, and, you know, like the iCore or the Core i7 or Core i5, you know, and all this, doesn't that make learning discrete assembly very complicated these days?
It is to some point. Also, the Raspberry Pi is ARM architecture. It uses load and store instructions.
Oh, speaking...
You have to do your operations on the register, on the CPU registers, on like the x86 architecture.
But back to ROM hacking and assembly, that's one thing I was always told by people doing extensive translation projects, is having to learn, say, 6502 assembly for the NES, or it was like 65812 or whatever the processor was in the SNES for assembly for that, just to try to work out places for blank, you know, bits of blank space in a ROM just to fit more text.
Mm-hmm.
Or how to, safely shuffle things around within the same space without having to expand a ROM, because that tends to give problems from what I've heard.
Yeah, that's why that was the old way things were, people were doing things. Then someone actually learned assembly for the consoles and learned how to actually use it properly and did a translation which blew everyone's mind.
Which translation was that? Because I've seen
It was a translation for Final Fantasy V.
Oh, I've played different versions of that fan translation. But every year I play Final Fantasy V at least once, because there is a charity project that goes on during summer called the Final Fantasy V 4-Job Fiesta. I don't know if you've played Final Fantasy V at all.
Let me see. I'm looking for the article. Okay. All right. As some two freaks translated lines of Final Fantasy V's Japanese dialogue to English, Myriad tried to figure out the best way to implement them into the game. She downloaded a disassembler to break down Final Fantasy V's code, turning it into a file so massive she needed a special text management program called X3 Gold just to parse it. Then she started changing variables using trial and error to discern what each line of code actually did. There were no references on most of this stuff at all, Miria said. I just kind of figured out what to do. Each file of the disassembly looked something like this, and there's a screenshot of assembly. This particular snapshot shows the code of Final Fantasy V used to render dialogue. Since the game assumed that every Japanese character will have the same width, 12 pixels, this code would tell each dialogue box to render a character, then move the invisible cursor 13 pixels to the right, render a new character, and so on.
For English letters,
which have varying width, Miriam needed to find another approach. The natural solution to modifying this code for an English translation is to vary the amount of cursor moves to the right based on which character is being drawn, Miriam said. I replaced this code with a jump to extra code I added that determines the amount to adjust the cursor based on the English character being drawn.
Oh, wow. Variable width font. The talk about it. That's impressive. That brings back some memories.
Yeah. Maria spent the whole summer sorting out solutions to these problems, which made her something of an outlier among the fan translation community. Previous fan translations had never even thought to disassemble the code or alter the dialogue renderers, perhaps because they weren't as passionate or obsessive as Maria. A lot of this was pretty tedious, she said. A lot of it was spending time in emulator SNES 9X, trying to figure out what's going on with the ROM and looking at hex dumps and assembly dumps for many hours and just trying to debug this annoying text routine. Midway through the project, they brought in a new editor, Katsuyuki Harmony 7 Omuro, an upperclassman at Mirus High School. Omuro thought Some Too Freak's translation were flawed and full of problems. Some Too Freak was young and not a native Japanese speaker, so Omuro started going through the script and revising big chunks of Some Too Freak's work. Frustrated by this decision, Some Too Freak quit the group, although he would go on to help translate more big RPGs in the following years, like Final Fantasy III and Seiken Densetsu III.
Two of my favorites.
Yeah.
You know, I remember being in the emulation community in the days when those games were first, you know, fully translated, and everybody thinking it was such an amazing, you know, accomplishment. And now actually hearing what people had to go through, not even for the English, but to get the English back into the ROM is impressive. Back in the day, a lot of people took it for granted just how much work went into that, because when I was in, back at the time when I was using that tile layer or that tile editing program that I was talking about that I did the vulgar Super Mario Brothers edit with, I ended up, you know, finding a group that was looking to do a fan translation of the Pokemon trading card game for Game Boy, because we didn't know whether or not it was going to be coming out in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Well, being the graphics guy, quote unquote, my main job was to try to redo a title screen while also changing the win-loss graphics, which at the time were in kanji. And I was having to do this again, literally pixel by pixel on each tile. And I found out later on that the quote-unquote project lead for the translation group was a 13-year-old kid, and that all of the text for the cards was coming off of his own personal collection. I didn't know that at the time, though. You know, the things you don't know, obviously, when you're on the internet, is just knowing somebody from text on a screen.
Yeah.
You know, we put out one very, very, very rough beta patch. Basically, he jammed in an alphabet and did some very basic intro, you know, text, you know, for the tutorial.
Mm-hmm.
And had my modified graphics and modified title screen in. And not long after that got released, he got a nasty gram in his email from Nintendo saying, "Yeah, you're going to stop this project or we're going to sue you into the Stone Age." But at the time that we were doing that, you know, we had announced our names to the community as, I forgot what we called ourselves. It was something pretentious. I think it was something like Trans Otaku. But I got at least 20 people in my email inbox every day asking, "Can we please make Pokemon whatever in English? Or can I, you know, make an English version of so-and-so and so-and-such," when it wasn't that simple. And besides, I wasn't the translator. I was just doing editing. We didn't even have a translator. Like I said, the guy was, you know, making up the tutorial stuff as he went, and for all the cards was, you know, like literally taking the data off his own Pokemon card collection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was perhaps the most clown shoes project I'd ever been a part of, but. Who am I to complain? But it was sad, though, because people thought all we had to do was just run a ROM through a program, and suddenly out came English.
It's not that simple, but people always assume it's simple.
That's especially hard in a lot of cases because in many cases, I've seen two different groups translate the same bit of Japanese dialogue and come out with almost completely different or completely different meaning, but with the same general words.
Mm-hmm. And there are some language quirks. For example, I saw a very stupid discussion at one time about someone who, on Japanese, someone gave a pill to someone and the word was nomu, that's drink it. And some were saying that's the correct translation, and some translated it as drink it, others translated it as eat it. And actually, Japanese and Spanish have that same quirk. In Spanish, the verb is tomar, which is drink, and also it's to take. And for medicine, you don't drink medicine, you take the medicine. And me, as a native Spanish speaker, to me it was natural to think the translation was actually take it, not or tomatela.
Okay, that makes sense.
So take it as a medicine. But the guys at the internet community were fighting and arguing that it should be literally translated as drink it. The others were saying that eat it, and I thought to myself, it's neither. It's take it.
Well, to be fair, being in the anime otaku nerd community for as long as I have, I have seen people fight over the dumbest things, like whether the proper name is Eris or Aerith for the staff using girl in Final Fantasy VII, whether you properly call him Guts or Gatsu for the main character of Berserk.
Well, that's actually the author's choice.
Right.
It's the author that decides what is the correct one.
Yeah. I've seen so many arguments over matters of Japanese translation where there's confusion over the L's and R's. I've seen the same character's name translated as Mara, Mala, Mauler, particularly for a blonde-haired demon from Oh My Goddess. It's just people find the funniest things to be exacting about. It's like, again, being in the Sailor Moon. Go ahead.
I can tell you it's a how should I put it? It's a desire to feel special.
It may sound
very rough, but teenagers and insecure, they like to feel special, and they are assholes with anyone else, and they have this idea of creating a very selective club and excluding everyone else and feeling themselves exclusive, like chosen ones or special people, for very stupid things.
Oh, I know. And I mean,
sort of a need to believe they are better than the others. The only thing it does is prove the contrary to what they want to prove. Well, I'm getting late. I need to go to sleep now.
Anyway, where are we? Okay, linkage. Oh, Kotaku. I don't think I've actually seen this article. Oh, and these were high school kids. No kidding.
Yeah. that golden time when you, that golden age when you have time to do all that stuff.
Now, if they would, okay. Now, I don't get the name Myria. Oh my goodness! Some of these are painful.
Myria.
Right. Like an incomplete fan translation of Dragon Quest 1 and 2 for the NES. They've since completed that. Yeah, oh, I don't know what that... What?
Hello, Galara.
Oh, Galara. Oh, hey. Karana, thank you for popping into my stream when I was doing Dragon Warrior 7 today. It was good to have you. Oh, that is painful to look at. I just came across the... Oh, no, they're actually showing the official PlayStation 1.5 translation. That was painful.
I need to go to sleep now.
You need to go to sleep? Well, thank you for talking to me for a while.
You're welcome. Same here. Okay, good night.
You have a good night.
Same to you. Thanks.
If you want to participate more directly in the podcast, you can send us an email at ultimacodex@gmail.com, or if you're feeling a bit braver, you can leave us a voice message in one of three places: the podcast website, our Facebook page, or on anchor.fm. You're also welcome to join us on Discord to chat with us and to lurk or contribute to podcast recordings when they happen. If you want to join the Ultimate Dragons, you can do so at udic.org, where you can choose your very own dragon name. You can also find the Ultimate Dragons on Facebook and on Google+. You can follow at Ultimate Dragons on Twitter, or join them on Slack or Discord. And if you're feeling really old school, you can even fire up a Telnet client and check out the Wearmount. If you'd like to support Spam 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 Humbug, you can do so at Patreon, where for as little as $1 a month, you can get access to episodes the day before they go live for everyone else. You'll also get access to behind-the-scenes audio on occasion, and possibly other interesting content. But if a monthly subscription isn't your thing, you can always buy your video games at GOG. We are a partner of that fine site, and every time you buy one or more games at GOG via the links on our websites or in the show notes, that helps us out. But we also welcome your moral support. You can like the Ultima series on Facebook, follow at Ultima Codex on Twitter, or leave the podcast a review on iTunes. And you're welcome to share our episodes with your friends and social media circles. Spam 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 Humbug is a production of the Ultima Codex. You can find show notes online at spamspamspamhumbug.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time, be virtuous.